The following program presented by the North Carolina Reading Service is for blind and print-impaired audience. And that program is the Indie Week, and it's read today by me, John Federson. The issue dated June the 1st of 2023. And it's a long issue today, and so I won't have time to name any of our 47 guest musicians for the theme music today. I'm very sorry to them. Your check's in the mail. And first, the published edition of Indie, which used to be weekly, is now only going to print every other week. And the caution is, if you want to stay up to date in between these issues, you can visit IndieWeek.com, as I do, because some stories, even with the new print edition, they don't make the deadline for print. So it's more, you get more articles and maybe more up-to-date articles at IndieWeek.com. However, they're connected to that is the story that the Indie Week has taken on a partner newsroom titled The Assembly. And they're going to be providing quite a few articles from an expanded list of correspondents, I believe. And so we'll get started in the print edition now, which is got 2 weeks' worth of news in it, so I better get talking. First up, Tomasi McDonald, one of the regular correspondents for Independent, writes, "Unprotected tenants. It's hardly a secret. There is an ongoing affordable housing crisis throughout the Triangle that's exacerbated by gentrification and a housing shortage. With that in mind, what state Democratic Party member who represents the region would approve legislation that further hinders its poorest residents from having safe places to live? Ask Adam Golden, a third-year student at Duke University Law School. Golden reached out to 19 Democrats in the North Carolina House about their April votes for House Bill 551, a GOP-led piece of legislation that would prohibit local governments across North Carolina from enacting source of income protections, that's SOI, protections for tenants. The omnibus bill would also require tenants who have service animals to provide written verification from a healthcare professional regarding their disability and need for the animal. And while there are what appear to be some minimal protections for people with disabilities and service animals written into the bill, legal experts and housing advocates say those don't actually do much to help people with disabilities. Golden has spent a significant portion of his law school career working with Legal Aid of North Carolina and the Duke Law Civil Justice Clinic, representing tenants in evictions and other proceedings. And Golden wrote in May the 2nd email to state lawmakers following that vote on April 27th, SOI protections ensure that those using housing vouchers, veterans benefits, or other non-traditional incomes can have choice over where they live. In the message, Golden noted that here in North Carolina, more than 80% of housing choice voucher, also known as Section 8, holders are people of color, and nearly a quarter are disabled, according to data from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. The legislation, Golden explained in a second email to Democratic members of the state Senate, which had not yet voted on the bill, the Senate, would preempt cities and counties from passing these protections for their residents, making it more difficult for those with disabilities that require a service animal to bring their animal into their home and force tenants to pay uncapped attorney's fees to their landlords if they appeal their eviction. He explained, "Every day in the courtroom I see firsthand our failure to provide safe and adequate housing for all, including many forced out of their long-time homes and frequently into homelessness. Golden added, housing vouchers are one of the few safety nets for the growing affordable housing crisis and mark a congressional effort, quote, to move away from the public housing model and provide low-income families with more choice over where they live. In doing so, federal lawmakers hoped to break up class and racial segregation in housing. Jesse McCoy, the supervising attorney at Duke's Civil Justice Clinic, described House Bill 551 as horrific. I've seen a lot of bad bills, McCoy tells Indy, but this is really bad. McCoy, who helped launch Duke's eviction diversion program in 2017, says that under current law, North Carolina expressly forbids rent controls, except in specific situations. But he says, the problem with this bill is that it's trying to expand the law that allows landlords greater access to turn away state residents who rely on rental assistance. This is not a new thing. For years, landlords have refused housing to people who they find out have subsidized housing assistance. That has been happening. In North Carolina, there is no law that explicitly allows municipalities to institute their own SOI anti-discrimination ordinances, and traditionally, town and city attorneys have been wary of testing such broad ordinances out of fear of being sued, says Golden. But municipalities like Durham, Raleigh, and Winston-Salem have some levels of protections for tenants, if not official ordinances. For instance, for developments that receive city funds, landlords may not discriminate against tenants based on their SOI. Charlotte and Mecklenburg counties passed ordinances that protect renters in buildings that receive federal funding. Those practices don't go far enough to cover the vast majority of tenants in the state, however. Golden says many other states and cities have adopted SOI protections because they work. Examples include Atlanta, Louisville, and New York City, which is taking steps to strengthen enforcement of its SOI anti-discrimination laws. Furthermore, 19 states have SOI laws in addition to those states' major cities and counties. While the issue has mostly been partisan, with blue cities frequently passing protections despite oppositions from GOP legislatures, even some red states like Utah and North Dakota have statewide SOI protections. In Texas, Republicans introduced a bill similar to HB 551 after Democrat-led cities like Dallas and Austin sought to protect their residents from SOI discrimination. Still, more and more tenants are gaining protections across the country. HUD data show that denial by landlords decreases from 77 to 35% in areas with protections. And Golden adds, recipients are more likely to move into low-poverty, high-opportunity neighborhoods. And in what is essentially a high-demand seller's market, landlords continue to do just fine. Among the Democratic legislatures here in the Triangle who voted in favor of HB 551 were Zach Hawkins of District 31, which includes East Durham, B. Ray Jeffers of District 2, which includes North Durham, Joe John and Yalu of Raleigh, Renee Price of Hillsborough, and Maria Cervania of District 102, which includes Cary and Apex, according to the NC General Assembly website. Price, a freshman House member who served on the Orange County Board of Commissioners from 2012 until 2022 before winning a seat in the General Assembly, says she has long been an advocate of affordable housing and housing vouchers. She told the Indy about her vote for 551. Builders don't want these types of controls. And with smaller landlords, some of them are not really into being forced to accept these vouchers. Price added that the proposed legislation does not preclude cities and counties from working jointly with builders who may be offered incentives like tax breaks to build affordable homes. John, a former judge, says the bill, quote, has a mix of good and bad to address multiple issues. I ultimately voted yes in this instance, albeit unenthusiastically, because I support the increased protections for renters with disabilities and service animals. Cervania told the Indy that 551 has some good pieces, but she says that after fully researching the bill and talking with others, she now opposes the section that would preempt cities and counties from enacting ordinances prohibiting landlords from accepting housing vouchers, and would oppose the bill on that grounds if given another opportunity to do so. The last thing I want to do, she says, is preempt any county. McCoy, the Duke Clinic's supervising attorney, takes issue with the parts of the bill that lawmakers have interpreted as protecting people with disabilities and service animals. He says that in addition to creating the image that a prospective tenant has bargaining power, the bill, quote, inhibits the city and county from getting involved in any way. He also takes exception that the service animal section and the proposed legislation is intended to protect people with disabilities. He says landlords have been trying for years to figure out creative ways to kick people out with pets that are not authorized. And he added they have accepted that they can't deny service animals who help, for instance, members of the blind community. Instead, McCoy says he thinks the legislation will target the owners of animals who provide emotional support. He says requiring tenants to provide medical certification also crosses the line regarding a person's medical privacy. Concerns about landlords refusing to accept federal housing vouchers surfaced publicly in Durham in the wake of the coronavirus pandemic at the end of a federal eviction moratorium. Data from state courts show that the number of eviction cases across the state last year spiked to its highest level since 2019. That's the year before this moratorium and federal rental assistance. In Wake County, for instance, while eviction filings are currently happening at a lower rate than in 2019, evictions jumped to 9.5% last year. In 2021, the rate was 6.2%. Meanwhile, in Durham, Sarah D'Amato, who directs Legal Aid of North Carolina's Eviction Diversion Program, told the News and Observer in February, quote, the courthouse's eviction docket has now grown to 100 to 200 cases a week. Adding, trends over the last few months show that eviction rates in the Bull City are on pace to hit 2019 levels, if not higher. HUD data from 2019 show the median income of a voucher user was $13,500 a year. Hardly enough to afford adequate housing in the free market, says Golden. In Durham, the average monthly rent for a one-bedroom apartment is around $1,600, according to Rent.com. Moreover, Golden adds, currently only one in four qualifying families receives a housing choice voucher, and wait lists to receive one, quote, are often years long. Despite the challenges, Golden says the voucher can be a lifeline, reducing the likelihood of homelessness by three-fourths, of living in an overcrowded home by half, and of moving in a five-year period by a third, according to data from HUD. Golden told the legislators that as a consequence of federal law not requiring landlords to accept vouchers, somewhere between 20 and 40% of voucher recipients are unable to find a willing landlord in the allotted time. McCoy notes that tenant discrimination, as seen in this bill, is a piece with historical practices in the South that are rooted in racism, with the legacy of property owners refusing to comply with government telling them what to do with their property, dating back to slavery. McCoy says it's a relic of Jim Crow, pre-civil rights slavery and redlining. Far from partnering with the state's GOP lawmakers to codify a law that forbids cities and counties from enacting anti-discrimination ordinances, Golden says the administration of housing vouchers is a local issue that should be left to local decision makers. Quite simply, He told the Democratic lawmakers, "I find such a vote by those who profess to care about vulnerable North Carolinians to be unconscionable." Over to Raleigh and a column by Jasmine Gallup called Skate Space. The formerly abandoned, sprawling asphalt lot located off Capitol Boulevard heading into downtown doesn't look like much right now, but in a few weeks, new ramps and curbs could draw dozens of skateboarders to the area. The Conlon Family Skate Park, a 2.5-acre space for skateboarders, BMX bikes, and roller skaters to gather, is the creation of Raleigh residents Stephen Mangano, an app developer, and Cody Charland, a marketing professional. Each has children who skateboard, and Charland is a long-time skateboarder himself, although he uses skateboarding more as a means of transportation these days, he says. Together, Mangano and Charland formed Skate Raleigh, a nonprofit designed to advocate for the construction of a larger, permanent skate park in the city. The temporary Conlon Family Skate Park is named for a local family that is the park's primary donor. Charland says, "Really, I'm thinking about my two sons. I don't want them to grow up without the right skate facilities, us having to drive to Durham or Cary. We have enough space downtown that we can do this. It's just up to us to make it happen." Raleigh has a large skate community, Charland adds. Multiple pro skaters have come out of the area, including Reggie Barnes, who competed in the 1980s and now owns a skateboard company headquartered in North Carolina. For all those skaters, though, there's only one skate park, Marsh Creek on New Hope Road, currently in Raleigh, a city of 500,000 people, Charland says. And he says, "Skaters are having to skate in unsafe places because there's nowhere else to go. That's why people make do-it-yourself skate parks." In addition to housing, grocery stores, and other critical infrastructure, he says Raleigh needs places of belonging. Kids and teenagers used to gather on the baseball field. He says now the city needs new third places where adolescents can go. And Mangiano agrees. He says, "More than ever, kids of all ages need a way to connect. In skate parks, there's a ton of diversity from gender, race, socioeconomic standpoint, so kids can come together. It is a very supportive environment." Skating has other benefits, he says. It's different from team sports, where kids might be grouped together by neighborhood or school. Skating has more cross-community interaction. The sport is also still very kid-driven and approachable, as opposed to other sports that have become adultized, he argues. In skating, everybody is supporting each other to get that next trick, and you're advancing individually. You're really pushing yourself against yourself. For years, public officials and city planners have looked at skateboarders as an undesirable element. Police across the country have stopped kids from skateboarding in parking lots, accusing them of loitering, confiscating skateboards from people rolling down sidewalks. Urban amenities are designed to keep skateboarders away. Today, however, attitudes are changing. Stephen Bentley, director of Raleigh's Parks, Rec, and Cultural Resources Department, says he's excited about exploring opportunities to create safe public spaces for people to skate. He says he's seen park directors in other cities oversee the construction of massive skate park complexes and recognizes they're meeting a need that is also present in Raleigh. The Conlon Family Skate Park is an important first step toward creating additional permanent places to skate in Raleigh, says Bentley. The skate park, located on 14 acres of city-owned land, is expected to have to close in 2 years to make way for Smoky Hollow Park, formerly the Devereaux Meadow Park. Construction on Smoky Hollow Park is expected to begin in 2025, but in the meantime, as Raleigh officials finalize the design and finishing the permitting process, skaters will have a central place in the city to go. In the department's upcoming development of its long-term plan, staff will also talk to the skate community about creating permanent skating locations, says Bentley. "Let's engage the skaters on the vision for skating in Raleigh. How can we use this project to gain momentum and replicate it somewhere else? Charlotte's visit for Raleigh is a city that has dots, spots, and parks for skating. In addition to a large regional skate park with half pipes, bowls, and rails, Charlotte hopes to see smaller skating spots incorporated across the city. Quote, that means skating in really small corners of parks, spots that are unattended or underutilized in cities. Then we're going to create designated skatable places within existing parks. We want to ultimately create, if not a big regional park, more support for Marsh Creek Skate Park. We want to be able to create destination parks for skaters and skating. For now, Charlotte and Mangiano are simply looking forward to opening the Conlon Family Skate Park in June. Mangiano says the park is plaza style, which means it's made up mostly of basic features skaters could find on the street. That means it's also more accessible for beginner and intermediate skaters who may be intimidated by the steep drops at Marsh Creek, says Mangiano. The plan includes a rail, a set of stairs, and box jumps. Mangiano says he hopes to eventually add a quarter pipe and other BMX-type jumps. Most of the elements are designed to be movable, so they can be relocated to a new skate park once Conlon closes. Mangiano says the idea is just to give the kids a safe place to skate and hang out and practice action sports. Ultimately, I hope it attracts more kids to the sport and builds momentum towards something bigger and better. He adds, the skate park supports families. It supports the community. It supports creativity. Hopefully, we'll have DJs out there and roller skating nights. Bringing the community together is truly the purpose. Now, from Wake County, Mariana Fabian writes, A Dance of Their Own. And it's got a trigger warning. This article contains references to suicide. On September 22nd of 2010, Tyler Clemente jumped off the George Washington Bridge after his roommate live-streamed his first gay date. It was an event that stuck with Holly Atkins, who grew up in New York City and recalls seeing the bridge from the window of her home. When she went to sleep, the memory of Clemente stayed with her, as did the deaths of LGBTQ youth she learned of through media reports and the countless others that were never publicized. She says, Clemente hadn't come out to anyone, including his parents, so the live stream was a very traumatic thing for him to find. But it was his death that motivated Atkins to start Hope for Teens, an anti-bullying nonprofit that works to advocate for and support LGBTQ youth, just like him. I told my husband I wanted to volunteer at some place that helps kids, said Atkins. He said, okay. And I did a search as far as nonprofits and youth nonprofits, and there were none for Wake County. So I went back to my husband 2 days later and said, we don't have any. I'm starting one. Atkins sketched out the name, logo, and catchphrase on a napkin, and Hope for Teens was born. Drawing inspiration from Durham's Inside Out, that's a youth-led nonprofit for queer teens, Atkins collaborated with the organization and used it as a reference to shape her group. Seeing the work that Inside Out has done in Durham over the last 13 years, I enjoy the confidence that those kids have, says Atkins. To come be among their peers, celebrate themselves, it takes a lot of courage. There's closed-minded people who just want to shut down that kind of freedom and confidence for no reason. These days, Hope for Teens frequently visits middle school and high school gay-straight alliance meetings to let students know they have their support. After one of these meetings last April, Atkins overheard members discussing why they weren't planning to attend their school-wide prom. Atkins says they were like, oh, are you going to prom? No, like, why would I go to prom with people who made my life hell for the last 4 years? Atkins suggested going to queer prom to the students, and they told her they didn't have one. That spoke volumes to me, Atkins said. She asked if there was anything for queer students, and they told her no. And I said, there will be next year. Atkins and her team of five board members and three student ambassadors worked to ensure every vendor they partnered with for queer prom was part of the LGBTQ community. She wants the teens to see the various industries and areas they can work in, she says, so they know they can be LGBTQ and be an integral part of society. The theme for this year's prom is Superheroes Among Us, Atkins says, as she feels every teen should be celebrated for their bravery in being who they are. Every sponsorship level for vendors who donate to the prom is a different superhero that's part of the queer community. The prom won't cost students any money to attend. Students register, and their friends as allies are also encouraged to join. Drake Gomez, a student ambassador at NC State University for Hope for Teens, has helped the organization raise awareness for the queer prom. Gomez created a list of LGBTQ-friendly or LGBTQ-centered organizations, groups, and businesses for Hope for Teens to potentially partner with. He facilitated conversations with the nonprofit and these groups to see if they could sponsor, volunteer, or contribute in any way. Gomez says the nonprofit's mission and values sparked his interest in being an ambassador of Hope for Teens. Gomez said, I believe in what Atkins is trying to accomplish, and with her connections to the LGBTQ community, as far as in education, high schools, and now even in college, I think she's going to have reach to a massive amount of students in this community that hasn't been seen before. Atkins says events like the Queer Prom in Wake County means queer teens are finally being seen, validated, and celebrated as who they are. Queer prom isn't a completely novel idea. The LGBTQ advocacy nonprofit Equality North Carolina hosted a similar event last fall, but only for adults over 21 who didn't get to experience their prom the way they would have wanted to. But without a celebration of and for queer students from their local school district, the queer prom is filling a void for local teens. Atkins says the teens seeing these vendors who are LGBTQ gave them a sense of community. She says Hope for Teens anticipates hosting this prom every year from now on in the first weekend of June for the beginning of Pride Month. Atkins says having the chaperones be from various different industries, backgrounds, hopefully opens up the conversation more for people to say, wait a minute, like we just had, you know, gender-affirming care needs be banned in our state politics. Why are we not reporting on the good news that trans kids are being celebrated for who they are? After the prom, Gomez says he hopes queer youth throughout the county, and beyond see the support of the community has in Raleigh. He wants the teens to know that there's a larger community for them outside of their hometowns, and there will always be advocates fighting for them. Even though queer prom is happening in Wake, Atkins and the rest of Hope for Teens encourages students from all counties in North Carolina to attend if they can. And there is a sidebar. The first queer teen prom of Wake County is happening tomorrow, June the 2nd. If you can't attend, that's a Friday, or would like to support Hope for Teens cause, check out their GoFundMe, which is gofund.me/2C4BB4DD. gofund.me/2C4BB4DD. And back to Durham, column by Audrey Patterson. about Durham City Council members and a proposal for the Carver Creek apartment complex. Durham's affordable housing efforts got a boost last Thursday as City Council members voiced support for a $6 million project that would preserve and develop over 100 residences. At a council work session, the nonprofit Housing for New Hope, HNH, asked the city for over $3 million, and five of six members present showed enthusiasm for the proposal. That $3 million would go with another $3 million already approved by the county commissioners in early May. The commitment is contingent on the city council's official approval of the project. City officials have repeatedly said affordable housing is a top priority as rents and home prices have skyrocketed in recent years, boxing out scores of Durhamites, many of whom have decided to relocate. The 2023 North Carolina Housing Coalition report found that 48% of Durham renters had difficulty affording their homes. Earlier this year, HNH estimated that the city's unsheltered population, homeless people who live in places like cars, stairways, and commercial buildings, has increased 10% over last year. But as the unsheltered population grows, says Russell Pierce, the HNH executive director, we are losing more affordable housing across the state, from what we understand, than we are constructing. Pierce stressed the need for deeply affordable supportive housing that provides resources to combat conditions often faced by people experiencing chronic homelessness like substance use disorders, mental health challenges. HNH already oversees two such communities in Durham. By acquiring the Carver Creek apartment complex at 531 East Carver Street, HNH would be able to develop and preserve 100 to 120 units of supportive housing. The location next to another HNH property would accommodate 45 of the new units. Mayor Elaine O'Neill asked at the work session, where would that money come from? City Manager Wanda Page responded, Durham's affordable housing budget, quote, would not be able to cover something of this magnitude. The $3.025 million would have to come from the city savings. And O'Neill said, I do think that we can justify going into our savings. This does fall into a unique category for our most vulnerable and marginalized community members. The overall $6 million request would cover only the buying price of the land. HNH mentioned other partners, including Alliance Health, Duke University, and Duke Health, that are interested in financially supporting the development of the units and services. Currently, the property is under contract with HNH and has a projected closing date of June 28th. It's coming right up. The acquisition of Carver Creek would not only allow for 45 new units, it would also keep the current tenants housed. In 2024, the Carver Creek complex, which serves low-income residents, will be at its 30-year expiration of protections, meaning that a private developer can buy the property. Pierce noted that as of today's residents, 60% are on government subsidies and would likely struggle to find new affordable housing. As it turns out, other publicly funded properties could also be reaching the end of their protections. City Council member Jillian Johnson said, it's kind of scary that there might be a bunch of other buildings out there we don't know about that we might lose, and that we've got folks living in that we want to make sure we can continue to house. And Pierce said in an interview, we really do look forward to partnering, not just in the development of Carver Creek, but also partnering to help so that we as a community can have a plan to address the potential loss of other properties. At the work session, representatives of several key organizations voiced their support for Carver Creek acquisition. These include the Community Empowerment Fund, the Criminal Justice Resource Center, Durham CAN, Durham Congregation and Action, and Urban Ministries. Now, Jeremy Bergman from CAN, who identifies as a low-income disabled veteran, said, "I have a pretty good life now. The biggest factor is that I live in affordable housing and I have been able to access mental health services." Along with O'Neill, council members Leonardo Williams, Mark Anthony Middleton, Javiera Caballero, and Monique Halsey-Hyman expressed their support for the project and urged other community stakeholders to get involved. Between May 2018 and May 2022, average rents in Durham and Chapel Hill surged about 25%. And in that same period, median purchasing prices for Durham homes soared about 40%. Meanwhile, the number of unsheltered people in Durham has increased 105% over the last 3 years. Williams says, "I think this is an opportunity for us to engage the broader community to be players in solving this crisis. There are a lot of folks that are sitting in the audience or on the sidelines watching, and I challenge them publicly to get into the game." The last days of Village Lanes, writes Sarah Edwards. One Monday morning, evening in May, members of the Splitskrieg League began to arrive at Village Lanes in East Durham. Some dragged suitcases up to the door, which has a stenciled sign posted to it, "Going out of business balls, $25. The suitcases also contain balls specially weighted that the most serious participants bring with them on league nights. Broadly speaking, though, Splitskrieg is not particularly serious. Described as some members as the Aging Indie Rocker League, it has met every other Monday night since 2007, mostly as an excuse to socialize. Russ Dean, who runs Splitskrieg, says, "We started out with 10 teams and expanded to 20. We are known to be the Not Good Bowling League, but bowling is secondary." When Village Lanes was built in the early 1960s, bowling was at an all-time high. Investment in the industry was so intense it caused a bowling bubble, and the number of alleys doubled to 11,000 by 1963. But, like malls, arcades, and other recreational spaces, bowling alleys began to recede in number and prominence toward the end of the 20th century. The bubble burst. In 2012, only 3,470 alleys were open nationwide, and by 2022, that number dropped to 2,800. This year, Village Lanes joins the ranks of the shuttered. Owner Renee Dennis declined to comment for this story, stating the sale of the space has not finalized. But the business management wrote in their official statement, "While our business has been successful, thanks to so many loyal customers, we are choosing to close Village Lanes to focus on other endeavors. There are plans to sell the property, and the buyer plans to repurpose the building for another use." And on May 31st, that is yesterday as I read this, the bowling alley closed for good. Tonight, though, when this article was written, Village Lane is as alive and well. Outside, the parking lot is hemmed by woods and the lurking early summer scent of wisteria. Inside, 20 teams, each comprised of four players, are spread across the alley's 40 lanes, crowding around pitchers of light beer to wait their turn. The alley's interior seems frozen in amber, with a vintage palette of seafoam blues and salmon pinks. It's one of the last alleys to still have wooden lanes, and the scoreboard consoles are decades old. Every few seconds, the conversation din across the room is intercepted ever so slightly by the faint sound of a ball making contact with pins. Dean says from his seat at one of the scoreboards, where he is manually inputting teams, It's a lot of math. Since 2007, he has kept a spreadsheet of every team's scores. Exactly two bowlers in the 15 years since the league's genesis have scored 300. Mike DePasquale in 2018, Jeffrey Berry in 2022. Perfect games. Jennifer Peters, a member of a team named Valley of the Balls, moved to Durham in 2010 and joined the league at a friend's suggestion. She said, "If you want to meet people in Durham, come bowl," says Peters. Shortly thereafter, Peters met her future husband, Mark Oates, at a league night. They've been married since 2020 and still show up every Monday, though they've agreed to keep a healthy competitive buffer between them with membership on different teams. And Dean says of Splitskrieg, "We've bucked the trend. We've been able to keep people coming out after all these leagues died out." Two decades ago, Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam published Bowling Alone, a treatise on the disintegrating fabric of American social life. Where people had once gathered in churches and participated in clubs, Putnam reasoned suburban sprawl and the deteriorating labor laws of the post-war years caused individuals to work longer hours, further apart, conditioning Americans to become functionally atomized. The rising number of solo bowlers was just one example of the phenomenon. In lower-income areas, these factors are exacerbated by an alarming inequity of public spaces. Studies have long demonstrated that areas with high poverty rates correlate with lower access to recreational areas, particularly well-maintained ones, making the community businesses that do exist particularly precious. In East Durham, Village Lanes and Wheels Fun Park have long served as two such spaces. Village Lanes has been a community fixture with abundant programming for both children and adults for 60 years. And for 40 years, Wheels, a skating rink that sits just a little over a mile from the bowling alley off North Hoover Road, has been a hangout spot particularly beloved by young people, a destination for grade school birthday parties, and a first taste of Friday night independence for generations of teenagers careening around the rink to YMCA. In 2020, after owner Becky Ulbricht decided to retire, the city announced that it would buy Wheels and turn it into Splash and Play, a community aquatic center. When residents advocated that that skating rink be retained, the city folded it back in. Over the phone with Indy, Durham Parks and Rec Culture and Community Manager Mary Unterreiner confirmed that the projected opening date for that skating rink is spring of 2024, followed by the Aquatics Center of 2025. Village Lane has had a less happy ending. When its sale was announced earlier this year, the news caught employees, many of whom have a long history with the alley, by surprise. Bryson Rogers, manager of Village Lane's Pro Shop, has worked at the business for 13 years. Ownership told him it was just time, he says, but he wishes he had been given enough notice to come up with a way to save the bowling alley. Quote, "I don't know if they can see the future, an economic collapse, or if they were just retiring. I don't know if I'll ever get a true answer, but the facility itself was profitable. It was making money." Village Lane's loyalists affirm the demand. "My kids have had their birthdays here," said Eric Thomas, a Splitskrieg bowler. "It's ingrained in the community. We can go somewhere else in Durham, but in an area changing so quickly, we're losing such a cool place. It was something like a church, like a church community, on a weekly basis, with fellowship." Now, the book Bowling Alone was published in 2000, just after the advent of the Internet and years before the pandemic splintered public life, making all of us, particularly older Americans, just a bit more lonely. For its part, Village Lanes hosted two bowling leagues specifically for seniors. Fred Cooley, a Village Lanes employee who helped lay the concrete down for the lane renovations back in 1989, says the business is one of the only spots in East Durham where seniors have been able to enjoy time together. Unlike some other recreational sports to pick up recent traction, like pickleball, bowling doesn't require excess mobility. Rather, the art lies in experience and precision, in the grip, address, and release of the ball. Cooley says a lot of elders bowl in three or four leagues because they don't have a lot to do. They can barely walk to the lane, but then it's a strike every time. Dean fondly remembers bowling for many years next to the Hazel Plumbers, a senior league named after a particularly prolific elder bowler. After he began seeing obituaries with the Hazel Plumbers League as a proud biographical footnote, he jokes it became a goal for Splits Creek to be in people's lives, so long that it ended up in their obituaries. Eddie Barnes is 77 and has been bowling at Village for 40 years alongside his wife Evelyn. The couple goes bowling at the lanes on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Fridays. For many years, Barnes was on the cusp of a perfect game with multiple scores of 299. And in 2018, at a tournament, he bowled a 300. To this day, he wears a ring with the date of the game engraved on it. Just about all of our friends are bowlers, he says. Teresa Faulkner worked at Village Lanes for many years, practically raising her son behind the front desk. When he applied to college, he won a scholarship for bowling. She says, people don't have a lot of affordable places to go to. It took everything else away from the seniors and youth. Everywhere else, you got to drive. In the Triangle, there are only a handful of bowling alleys left, and in Durham, there is now just one, Bolero Durham, just off 15501, which belongs to the Bolero Corporation. On May 22nd, Village Lanes, which had already been unofficially closed for a week, opened its doors to Splits Creek one last time. About 100 people showed up to celebrate the space and the community they had built around it. You could say that Village Lanes is the relic of another era or an older Durham, but perhaps you could also say that about any good unprotected part of the city. Begrudgingly, people are moving on. Dean says that Splits Creek will decamp to Bolero. Faulkner, who is described by members of Splits Creek as the fairy godmother of the group, affectionately says she will follow the league anywhere. And Barnes has been hired for a new job as operations manager at Bolero. Eventually, he hopes to find an investor who will help fund the opening of a new Durham bowling alley. Cooley, meanwhile, isn't sure of his next steps, but he loves bowling and loves the steady care it inspires. For years, when not himself participating, he's watched bowlers cast balls down those wooden lanes. He says it's not about how hard you do it, it's about putting the ball in the right place. Jasmine Gallup again. Stories from the Roadshow, PBS's Antiques Roadshow. In a crowded plaza outside the North Carolina Museum of Art, a middle-aged man named Nathan pulls out yellowed papers, diagrams, and other memorabilia from World War II, one piece of history at a time. He tells the antiques appraiser in front of him, "This fellow was an author. He was at Guadalcanal during the third battle on the USS Sterrett." The appraiser, sitting at a table with a distinctive blue tablecloth, carefully leafs through the report and then, setting it aside, unfolds a detailed diagram of the ship. "The technical drawing is of the damage the ship took during battle," he explains. "You can see," he says, "all the different hits, where the mast was broken. They were doing a forensic study of the battle, like you would do in a robbery today." Nathan is one of the thousands of people who gathered in Raleigh earlier this month for the Antiques Roadshow. each hoping to find out the value of their knickknacks, collectibles, and attic antiques. A long-running PBS program brings experts from city to city to assess everything from Victorian-age books to 1960 movie posters. Collectibles appraiser Travis Landry says there are always surprises. When we were back in Arizona, a volunteer we'd been working with came up and laid her collection of Magic the Gathering cards. I'm like, you were standing next to me all day and you're just going to tell me now you got this beta set? You never know what you're going to come across. When it comes to assessing the value of antiques, appraisers look for different things. Landry, who does specialize in pop culture items like comic books, trading cards, and video games, has to know a little bit about everything to be able to navigate a broad category of collectibles. He says you might not know specifically what something is right off the bat, but you look for clues, play detective. You have to make your diagnosis like a doctor. And depending on what the item is, you have to look at it from a different lens. Still, there are a few factors most appraisers seem to consider. First, they have to determine if the item they're looking at is real or fake. Is it a genuine oil painting or a photographic print? Was it actually made in the 1920s or is it a replica? It's amazing what they can tell from small details, pinpointing the origin based on whether a doll is made from plastic or porcelain or how a book is bound. One PBS volunteer, Drew, brought in a cast iron fire engine for appraisal on behalf of a 93-year-old donor. Unfortunately, it wasn't worth much. According to the appraiser, the toy was a reproduction. In the old days, he says, iron was cast in sand, so the high grain pattern on the toy showed that it was made more recently. In addition, the condition is also important. If a piece's furniture is chipped and deteriorating, it's less valuable than it was in mint condition. Finally, the market matters, says painting appraiser Eric Hanks. He says, it's like everything else, tastes change. Somebody gets recognition, never got it before, and so that boosts their market. A lot of factors can play in. Recently, somebody brought in a painting from Austria. Their dad was in Europe and brought it back. When I did a little background research, 99% of the auction results were in Vienna. So in that case, the relevant market is actually back overseas. This month's event marks the second time Antiques Roadshow has come to Raleigh and its fourth time in North Carolina. Roadshow staff spent a full year preparing for their summer of travel, during which they visit five cities across the country, says executive producer Marsha Bemko. Each stop is an all-day event, with thousands of locals coming to get their antiques appraised and hundreds of volunteers and staff managing the guests and the cameras. Roadshow staff leave with hours of video footage, which then takes another 12 months to edit into 15 one-hour shows, says Bemko. The episodes featuring Raleigh are expected to premiere in the spring of 2024. The show is known for springing surprises on people, capturing their genuine reactions to learning an antique they picked up at a yard sale may be worth tens of thousands of dollars. These moments are engaging, but there's something about the roadshow that Bemko treasures even more. She says, my favorite thing is the stories we learn. They come from every man. We all care about the same things. In this world today, we need to remember that. We need to respect and appreciate each other's differences. What you're seeing today here is humanity, liking each other. All ages, all colors, religions, all political persuasions. Humanity was certainly on full display at the Raleigh Roadshow. People from across the state flocked to the art museum with films, furniture, and even Furbies. Items came in all shapes and sizes, from large mystery antiques lugged in on handcarts to smaller relics wrapped in blankets and beach towels. It was quickly evident that every person there had a story. Ann and Richard, an elderly married couple from Pittsburgh, came in part to get an antique doll of Queen Elizabeth appraised. Ann says, "My grandmother gave me this 65 years ago. I've always been an admirer of the Queen. I wrote her a letter. She didn't write me back, but her lady-in-waiting wrote me back for the Queen." The couple also bought an antique cylinder phonograph, an ancestor of the record player. Who can remember that? The device was passed down from Anne's grandfather to her father and eventually to her son. The horn itself is beautifully painted. During the event, the couple learns it dates back to the 1800s. Together, the items are worth almost $1,000, but Anne says they plan to keep both in the family. Another guest, Dottie, says she also plans to hold onto the family heirloom, a beautiful diamond and pearl brooch that once belonged to her great-grandmother. The piece was valuable enough to make it in front of the cameras, but that wasn't a surprise, says Dottie. Although the brooch is small, most people have never laid eyes on something with that many genuine jewels, not to mention the large natural pearl. She says with a laugh, "I was curious to see what the appraiser's reaction would be, and I got just the reaction I thought I would. It's pretty startling. I'm very honored that it was in my family and that somebody was good enough not to sell it." The brooch likely dates back to 1910 or 1915, Dottie learns, when her great-grandparents lived in New York City. They were socialites, she adds. Seeing the brooch and hearing the family history, it's easy to envision a young couple living a life of glitter and glam in the roaring 20s. Even the few small details Dottie has about the brooch paint a vivid picture. That's the beauty of Antiques Roadshow. Not the antiques, but the history behind them. Holding a piece of something from a place and time that has long since passed. And finally, hearing the stories of neighbors and friends. You get really emotional with these people and their things. Demko says, "I already cried with a guest today, and he has a great story." I mean, ultimately, we watch the show for these great stories. And that's about the time I have for reading my stories of the week on Indie Week. John Feddersen with you from the North Carolina Reading Service. This program and others like it are available on the podcast section of the service online. And also, if you missed some of the articles that I did not have a chance to read, they are available at the IndieWeek.com website. There is no subscription fee right now. And in any event, I hope to be seeing you in a couple of weeks when I'll get to the next issue that I have to read from Indie Week. Bye-bye.